Accession number 9433, reel 5.
Mr. A.J. Smith, Reel 5. How did your training come to an end? How were you posted to France?
The training came to an end quite dramatically because we'd been out on the finishing the shooting course and marched back from beyond the Chatham, well out of Chatham. We arrived in the barracks and the captain in charge, whom we liked very much, he was wounded badly in France, but he was a real gentleman. An NCO came up to him and handed him a message from the orderly room, and he read it and frowned and so on, and then he said, "Well, I'm very sorry to have to tell you all that you are due to get an embarkation leave and go to France within the next week or two." He almost wept. He actually did. And he said, "You'll get this embarkation leave. We're just within a few days from now, and then it'll be coming back and off to France."
Now, you say he wept, or almost wept.
He did. He'd been badly wounded. He was very thin. He was very gentlemanly. And he felt it was, I suppose he felt it was wrong at the short training and to be switched, the whole lot of us, to France. We thought it was wonderful, actually.
Did you think you were fully trained? Were you confident in your training?
We were confident of our... Oh, yes, very confident of our training, and we'd never thought, any of us, about what training was. We just took the training given and felt we'd covered pretty well everything, and I'm afraid we were all rather nearly cheered when he said that we'd be off to France within a week or so.
Why were you so keen to get to France?
I suppose doing training, it didn't get boring within 3 months, but you felt it should lead to something, and you're all young together. We had nobody older than 19 in our company, so that we're all young, keen, no dependents, nobody hanging on to us. Pretty well nobody, and it was just a further adventure, really, even for a quiet person, and I would have been called a quietish person then. We were ready, we'd been fussed up quite nicely and told how smart we were and so on, and we thought, right, they're finished with this, let's get away. We were quite pleased, and the excitement in the barrack room, you know, throwing our kit off on the beds, or pulling the beds down and then throwing the kit on free, you know, was quite something. We were free to go abroad. That's what it comes to.
Now, you said you had 7 days embarkation leave. What can you remember about the leave?
Leave?
I know you were late back from it.
Yes. The leave, I can remember coming home. I can remember my parents then phoning, I suppose, my brother, who was in hospital up at something Pier. What is the place up north? What is it?
Wigan
Pier. Yes, he was in hospital at Wigan Pier, and he got leave to come down. They arranged that he could have leave to come down and see me before I went, and then it was a matter of I forget whether I got to church. The 7 days leave was very short. I probably didn't get to church to say goodbye to anyone. And during the leave, I can't remember doing much. As a family, we didn't do much anyhow, in wartime as much as that. So I would probably have been eating well, sleeping well, and talking to my brother quite a bit, because he'd had some months very badly wounded, so he probably was chatting up on those subjects. And then it was time to go back.
What did your parents think about you being sent?
Oh dear, there was upset there, of course, naturally. Upset only, my father wouldn't say anything, he never did say anything much. My mother didn't say anything, but she was moved, of course, a bit. And the worst day was when I had to just hop out of the house, get out of the house, and get onto an open deck tram to Hammersmith. That was a very painful time, both leaving and sitting on the tram. But once, of course, I got to Hammersmith, everything went very nicely. I mean, that was it. Except, as I've already said, we got back 2 or 3 hours late, from nearly all of us, and that was that. That was the one and only leave.
What preparations were made for going abroad when you got back?
When we got back, our kit was checked right through. All our kit was checked carefully to see that we had everything, and apart from that, I don't think there was any special preparation. It all seemed to come so quickly that I can't remember anything special, except that we were cleaning up, packing stuff, probably throwing bits and pieces away of our own stuff, and I can't therefore remember anything. We may have had a parade before the colonel, I expect, who was an oldish gentleman, very gentlemanly, quite old, and very nice actually. So I can't remember anything special. It was such a short period of days anyhow, getting ready. We'd already done gas tests and all those things.
Were you inoculated or vaccinated?
We'd already been inoculated before that.
Did you know you were going to France? Was there ever any question of you going to one of the other fronts?
Oh, no. We were told clearly we were going to France, and there was no question of any other front at all. We assumed, I'm afraid, that France was the place. The trainers, the people who trained us had all been to France. We had nobody, I think, that had been to India or anywhere else like that, so that France was the place, the Western Front, oh yes.
So could you tell me about what was the date you actually sent, and could you tell me about the
date?
The crossing.
Well, it was August the 6th that we assembled for the last time. They laid on a special supper for us at about 11 o'clock at night on the 6th of August. We had tinned salmon and something to go with it, some vegetables, and I don't know what else. We'd have a sweet. They made a special meal for us, a parting meal. And we also were given a letter pad, a pencil, and a message from, I don't know, it's the king or the queen, something like that. Each one had this little packet. Very nice. We were quite pleased with it, and the salmon certainly tasted very good, even though it's probably tinned. We hadn't had that in training. And that was the only special thing done.
So could you tell me about the crossing then?
Yes, well then, we marched through the town. I don't know whether I'd said before, but all the windows lit up in the houses and people got on their balconies. They were used to it. We had a full-size band, boys' band, with all the instruments, to Chatham Station. On Chatham Station, we walked down the stairs, all along the platform. The sergeant major, who we were never 100% pleased with, although he was all right, really, he came along a bit tearful. It's funny that. But anyhow, he came and spoke to most of us, you know, and shook hands and all that, all along the platform. And I think he was the only one that probably came. Oh, one or two sergeants turned up, undoubtedly. But then the train came in, we got in. This is, by the way, about probably 1 o'clock in the morning. And then we dithered round Kent, wandered along very slowly. We were well packed in, because all the kit and stuff, you don't fall over anything. There's everything piling up on you. And then when it became lightish, we found we'd reached Folkestone Harbour, right down in the harbour, and we detrained and came onto the piece of the front which was all wired, barbed wired off over there and over there. You couldn't get out of the camp. And I've no doubt, yes, we had a meal in a big hut built along the promenade, and then we went into, was split up between the houses which had been taken over, which were really small hotels all along the lower part near the harbour. We dumped our kit. I remember, you know, when we dumped it, mind you, we hit the skirting boards and the wall, but we didn't worry too much about that. We all the way around the rooms, and then we went out for a stroll along to look around, but no further than the barbed wire, which was only about 300 or 400 yards at the most, and then back, and we fallen in about 11 o'clock, I suppose, something like that, and marched onto the boat. It was quite a good harbour then. It's been altered a bit since, but we enjoyed that part, going onto the harbour, up the gangway with all our kit, and into the, of course we're carrying rifle and everything then, into the boat, onto the decks, of course, and within a very short while we pushed off. And as we came out of the harbour, the Navy was standing by with one or two destroyers, and our first sound of a shot was a naval chap was kneeling at the kneeling position on one of the destroyers, was aiming at mines that were floating, and he blew one up. So that was quite a good introduction, actually, these floating mines. He had to hit the point, and he hit it and blew up, and we then pushed off with this sort of escort in the distance. And that's the first time I saw a kneeling shot, the kneeling position used properly, you know, kneeling and firing, and he hit this this mine. So then we did not look back at the white cliffs of Dover. We didn't think of that. We were merely looking ahead, of course, to see France. But I know the white cliffs of Dover sung about a lot and all that, but afraid we didn't look back, we're just looking forward. And then we landed at, now let's work it carefully, if it's Calais or Boulogne. I think it was Boulogne. We landed at Boulogne. We detrained pretty well straight into a train, a big lofty train station sort of arrangement near the harbour, and got in a train and moved off to Etaples or Etaples.
So you crossed on the 7th of August?
On the 6th, oh yes, the beginning of the 7th, yes. We were 6th of, and then we left, that's right, on the 7th really. And we landed, well, we've landed, and we're now on the way to Etaples. We detrain at Etaples. We'd heard quite a lot about Etaples. Nothing as bad as has come out in a recent film. But we landed there. We were distributed to a large number of tents, which were dug into the ground about 2'6" below ground, and then the tent coming up, so that you step down, but you could stand up in the tent. We got quite a number in each tent, around the tent pole. We then went off to meals at a proper dining, army dining hall, and on that day we into an EFC canteen, not an EFC, what would it be in those days, anyhow, in a, it probably would be EFC, canteen, where we saw, oh dear, be careful, the Basewallers playing at long tables, which housey-housey, or whatever this new game is that's done on all places. Anyhow, somebody calling out this and this and this and this, but we watched them. They were earning good money at the base, getting good money at the base, and there they were playing it away in these games, in this huge canteen building, recreational place. So that was interesting to us, and they were oldish people, quite a lot of them, a good age.
What did you think of these base wallers?
Not much, of course. They were base waller, we'd heard about base wallers. They were paid much more than anybody else, and of course they were miles from any danger, so we didn't look on them with favour straight away. We'd heard about them. They were quite people, tradesmen, of course, and but they were base wallers as far as we were concerned. We were we were more important but much poorer paid. And pay was only necessary in order to be able to have something to spend. It wasn't looked upon as remuneration, it was something to spend. There wasn't a lot of it. So then, I should think we slept the night, that's right, in these tents. The next day we were assembled, but along with a number of others, a few, I was picked out to do sentry guard duty over German prisoners, hospital German prisoners, just in Etaps, I mean in the area around. In huge marquees they were. The rest of the draft went off to do something, some drills and so on the beach at, I wonder if it's right, Latuke, anyhow, one of the beaches nearby, and we went on guard duty. So I missed that part. I missed any drilling or being chased around, if they were. None of them complained about anything. When they came back, I was on guard duty, a number of us, around these huge marquees full of German wounded. Trenches were dug all round these marquees so that the prisoners could get in there if there was an air raid. There had been one or two air raids, one or two nurses killed, which then seemed a terrible thing, to kill nurses.
Did you have any contact with these German prisoners?
We just heard them coughing and grunting, and we saw one or two moving round slowly. No, but here's one of the most important parts. About, I suppose, very late midnight, and a nurse was going round on her rounds, and she came out and started chatting me, and she was a very classy person, and she chatted about London. You know, I came from London, she came from London. It was a very pleasing experience. I suppose she thought, this poor boy, this youngster, and so on. But anyhow, she was very charming. And I say we discussed London and other things quite a bit, and then she went off to finish her rounds in another marquee. And there were a lot of those people, VADs and all those, working in these sort of places, and it was real work, especially, as I say, one or two were killed just before then. But the bombs were very little. They dropped over the side, I believe, of the aeroplane. And then I don't think we stayed much. Oh, yes, we then were divided up. This was terrible. The draft of young people all trained together were divided A to K probably and L to Z. L to Z went to the 9th Battalion Royal Fusiliers. A to K went to the Royal West Kents, the 7th, I think, Royal West Kents. Now that was terrible because the people I'd been next to in the hedges and lake, and they went off. Well, they are H and, oh no, L evidently came in the deal, and they went off to the West Kents, 18th Division. We were transferred to Royal Fusiliers, the 12th Division, and they took our badges away, the Middlesex badges, the diehard badges, which we'd been told the diehards, the Middlesex, were the finest regiment on earth. We were pushed into the Royal Fusiliers, just an ordinary London regiment, we were told. Actually, it was high on the list of regiments. But anyhow, they gave us out our Royal Fusilier badges and things to be sewn on the... Oh, up here, I think. With a fuse, that's right. And so on. And our RF to be pinned in, to be fixed in the flap, the epaulette. And so we were Royal Fusiliers, and the others were Royal West Kents.
Did you protest about this, or did you accept it?
Oh, no, I'm afraid we accepted everything. No protests, no strikes, and no, we just took it all. They altered our discs that we hung around our necks, our identification discs. They altered mine not too well, because, you see, they're stamping RF over the top of the Middlesex Regiment, and the Wesleyan part remained very prominently, so they could bury, the Wesleyan chaplain could bury you. And then we didn't waste any more time there. We were popped into luggage, what do you call them, trucks, cattle trucks, and started moving off very slowly up towards the fighting.
How long had you been at a tarpaulin?
I should say 2 days, probably no more, 2 or 3 days. And we got in these trucks, I forget the number, 40 men and 8 horses or something, but anyhow, we were all spread along this long train. It drivelled along about 5 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, sometimes probably got up to 15. And they actually did, the lively ones of us, actually did hop out, jump down, pick a few flowers just and run along the train and hop on again. There was no danger of being left behind or deserting. They just enjoyed it, actually. And it was lovely weather, had the big sliding doors open. And mind you, there wasn't much room by the time all your kit was there. You couldn't run about. All the kit dumped on the floor of, say, 40 people, 40 kits and the 40 men. It was pretty close. But anyhow, we drifted on the train for quite several hours. That took us quite a way, but not an immense way. It took us up nearer to the fighting zone, and then we detrained somewhere and started marching. We were accompanied by officers that we got used to liking then, Lieutenant Spence, Lieutenant Isaacs. Those are the two I remember. They took charge of our party. The Royal West Kents, I don't know where they went off somewhere different. Anyhow, we did marching then. We'd slept in some old trenches. We were getting near to, see, there'd been a big advance from August the 8th, so devastation everywhere. We slept in a trench the first night, I think, we were out of the train. Old trenches that hadn't been used for probably 4 years nearly. And it rained, so we pinned waterproof sheets with our bayonets, which is nearly breaking the law, across the top of the trench so we could be a little less wet. And that then in the morning up, no undressing of course, it just plonked down. Then in the morning up and more marching, always going forward slowly. I mean, there was no chance of hurrying anything. It was still going through. The devastation got worse and worse, and we started finding trenches and roads and towns with the army names beautifully printed. Everything had been done well over the years.
And what was your impression of this devastated area?
The devastated area, we were very, very interested, because the nearer we got, the more the shell holes showed. Some old, very old, with weeds grown over, some newish. And it looked very real. Because if you march for 40 minutes and then rest for 10, you do that several times, that means quite a number of miles in the day. You begin to take less notice, possibly. You begin to get a bit warm and tired, in a way. And, yes, we didn't wear our tin hats then, or did we? I forget. But tin hats on the back of a pack weigh you back more, but perhaps we had those on, I forget. But this sort of marching with a night or two in between went on until we came to Flesselles, where there was a 12th Divisional wing and one or two others. It was a village still occupied by civilians. It had a few bad patches. But there they started a bit of training. Oh, yes. They had us out on parade and did the usual bout turn, right turn, left turn, and so on, and slope arms, present arms, shoulder arms, and so on. Very nicely, though, because these Lieutenant Spence had been out in France before and he'd come back. Isaacs was, oh dear, son of a banker, and he was a man of 30-odd, an officer. He was very knowing, he was very gentlemanly, terrifically. He could lecture, he gave us talks on various subjects, such as sanitary affairs and that. He had a terrific Jewish gift of lecturing and knowledge. He really was. He was on top. And Lieutenant Spence, on the other hand, was gentlemanly, charming, and he was on the way back, mind you, to what he already knew. We didn't. So then we drifted on further until we came one day to the first real things to do with war. We were going along a road. There's the ground slopes up here, and then it drops away over there, so we're marching along. Suddenly, a battery of artillery sent off one or two salvos. Now that's a terrific noise, so the line swayed. Oh dear, they're doing that in football pitches now. But anyhow, the line swayed a bit, the terrific noise suddenly. It was quite a nice, safe baptism. There's the battery firing over to the Germans. Terrific noise. But the beautifully, well, it was good, everything. And then we marched on, and now we had a night then. I remember one night, we slept in shell holes, about two to each shell hole, shell holes all over the place, and we noticed the rusty bits of shrapnel all over the place, and it rusts off apparently quickly. So we were getting near the line, the dew, and we put one ground sheet on the ground and one ground sheet over us because the nights were freshish. Anyhow, that was the one night I especially remember. Because of these shrapnel, we did say to each other, and it doesn't look as though you'd be able to miss it, really. Bits everywhere, little bits about so big, and rusting off because the dew sets them off straight away. But they were everywhere, and there were also lots of empty shell cases that had been used by machine guns, so chucked out and by troops. So we thought it was warming up rather well. And then, I suppose it would be the next day, a day happened, which was the 26th of August. We got to the 26th of August now. And on the 26th of August, we marched and marched and marched. And then the evening was coming on. It was sunset and all that. Evening coming on, and we found we were in real devastation. And lo and behold, we'd sort of lined up over this rough ground, and a captain came along to us. I found out later he was the adjutant, Captain Hilton, later town clerk of Torquay after the war. Anyhow, he came along and said hello and so on. That was funny. Yes, and he just said, now, if you smell gas, put your gas mask on immediately, and that's all he said. And then he led us off from one or two, an NCO or two, and we found fusiliers with their tin hats and everything else dotted about resting in shell holes, and yes, a few in a bit of a trench over there, but shell holes mostly. And they said, you and you join that little group, probably three or four in there. So you joined them, and then they took them out. You and they spread us all out between the platoons, the section between the platoons of the battalion, which means about 12 at least platoons. Yes, 3, 4, 12, something like that. This spreads us up hopelessly again. Of course, there again, you see, you're split right away. We were split right away.
Who now, were you assigned to? Which section?
To B Company, and to a rifle section of B Company. I can't remember the number, but B Company it was, and I stayed with B Company. Now, B Company, we had a sort of welcome. There was a sort of senior private. The NCOs had been shot off a lot. The senior private we were put in charge of, that means the oldest one, I think, anyhow, and been out longer. He said, you've come to a right mob. He said, our colonel, he says, he's whatever's got to happen, he says, my men can do it. And they were, you know, it was a sort of a bit of a cool reception, because I found out afterwards the arrival of a draft meant that you would be going into action, because when you'd been weak and resting, a whole mob of youngsters and or any others come down like that, they knew at once that, wow, we're for the high jump. So the response